Welcome to Now Appalachia. The Appalachian region covers 13 states in the U.S., and over 25 million people call the region home. This podcast profiles the authors and publishers with connections to Appalachia and how the region influences and impacts their creative work. And now, here's your host, author and Appalachian resident, Elliot Parker.
And hello, friends. We welcome you to another episode of the podcast program, Now Appalachia. And this program profiles the outstanding authors and publishers with connections to the Appalachian region and how those influences impact their works. And I'm your host, Elliot Parker. It's great to have you with us. We have an author joining us today who was with us way back when we first started our Now Appalachia program here on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. And he is back with his latest book. It is called After the Lights Go Out. His name is John Vercher, and we're delighted to have him here. And folks, let me tell you, this is a book that is harrowing, it is spellbinding, and it is a story about family. It's about the complications of mixed race relationships. It's a book about misplaced loyalties. And more importantly, it's about a story that focuses on the price athletes pay to entertain. And I'm so delighted to have John with us here today. And John Vercher joins us. He lives in Pennsylvania with his wife and two sons. He has a bachelor's degree in English from the University of Pittsburgh and an MFA in creative writing from the Mountain View Master of Fine Arts program. He is a contributing writer for WBUR and NPR, features his essays on race, identity, and parenting quite frequently. His debut novel, which we had him on a couple of years ago to talk about, called Three Fifths, was named as one of the best books of the year by the Chicago Tribune, Crime Reads, and Book List, and it was also nominated for the Edgar, Anthony, Lefty, and Strand Magazine Critics' Choice Awards for Best First Novel. And so we're delighted to have John back with us today to talk to us about his outstanding new book, After the Lights Go Out. So John, welcome back to Now Appalachia. So good to have you back with us today.
Thanks, Elliot. Thanks for having me back.
I'm so excited to have you here and to have you as a part of the program because I know you were working on another novel the last time we talked with you a couple of years ago, and you didn't. I knew you kind of had this book sort of thinking about it, and you were kind of toying with the idea. And it will be out on June the 7th, and it's just a wonderful story. And we'll get to it in just a second. But I wanted to ask you first. After you published Three Fifths, it came out and had all of this acclaim, and was a finalist for so many awards, all the major crime awards like the Lefty and the Edgar and all of that. You come back with your second book, After the Lights Go Out. As a writer, from a storytelling perspective and a craft perspective, how different was it writing this book as opposed to writing your first book? Did anything change in terms of your process? How you worked, how you put things together? Was it easier, more difficult the second time around? How did all of that come together in terms of working on book number two as opposed to book one?
It was very different, but for different reasons. My first book was actually my thesis for my MFA program. And so my process was sort of dictated by the deadlines of getting portions of the manuscript done for my mentors. And so there was more of a rigid schedule than I usually adopt for writing. I am not necessarily an ass in chair or certain word count by every day writer. I'm a little bit more by feel, which, you know, you can say what you want about that. Maybe I'm not as disciplined as some other writers, but it's a style that works for me. So in that sense, it was very different because I was on my own schedule this time. I wrote when I felt I could and wanted to write. And it was once that I found all the threads and how they were going to pull together in the book that I ended up becoming ass in chair writing every day. But it was because I had to get it out, not because I was forcing myself to hit a certain word count every day. It was flowing that well that I couldn't wait to get back to the next session to write more. Interestingly enough, though, it didn't start that way because I felt sort of a lot of self-imposed pressure to write another crime novel because I hadn't originally written. I didn't know Three Fifths was a crime novel until it got sort of that kind of recognition. And so I thought that this next one had to be that. And I, as I realized as I was writing it, I had no idea where it was going, and I didn't know what the character was going to be. It just didn't, it just wasn't working. And I ended up scrapping like 15,000 words, 20,000 words, and starting completely over, because I knew that this character and the progression he needed to take was not a crime story. It was really much more, I mean, I guess it's kind of crime adjacent. There's some noirish aspects to it maybe. So that part was very different too, like actually having to have this realization, like, oh, this is not the story I'm trying to tell.
Very good. And I want to ask you about throwing away those 15 to 20,000 words. Do you feel like, was there a moment where you thought, oh my goodness, maybe I don't need to pursue this idea or this character or this storyline because I got 15 or 20,000 words in and it obviously went nowhere? Or did maybe that embolden you to write the story that you really wanted to tell? Did you ever have a moment of self-doubt where you thought, well, maybe I just need to totally scrap this whole concept and work on something else? Or was it more motivating in that way?
It was way more motivating. I mean, it was frustrating because in those writing sessions, I did feel like I was just trying to hit a word count. Like I was, you know, after the first book, you know, it's out for about 5 minutes and then people are asking you, when's the next one? And so, you know, there was some of that pressure to, and again, self-imposed. It's not like anybody was unkind about it or anything. I mean, if anything, it's, you get to write the next book. It's exciting. It's not like you have to write the next book. So it was, but me being who I am with perfectionism and imposter syndrome, like I wanted to get it done. So when I realized, when I got to that 15, 20,000 words and was like, this is not a book I wanted to read. And that, I think, was the moment that turned a corner for me and then became inspiring, because I said, well, you know, Three Fifths was the book I wanted to read. And if I'm going to write a book that I don't want to read, then what am I doing? So, no, it was actually really empowering to go back and say, okay, I know I love this character. I want to tell what I think his actual story is. And that's when things just, I mean, everything fell into place, as cliched as that sounds, or as impossible as that sounds. But I mean, literally just things just started to drop, just fall into their right slots. And I was off to the races.
Well, as a reader, I'm so happy it went that way for you the second time around, because you've given us a terrific book here that I can't wait to talk with you about.
Thank you.
You've got a fantastic protagonist named Xavier Scarecrow Wallace, who's a mixed race MMA fighter who's on the wrong side of 30. He's facing sort of the fight for his life. And then you've got sort of a parallel story running on the other side where his father, Sam Wallace, is at the end of his life with end-stage Alzheimer's disease. And we'll talk about how those kind of dovetail in just a minute. But one of the things we learn about Scarecrow as he's going through his story is that he is losing his battle with something called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. And I know that has made news recently in the last few years with NFL football players, retired NFL players. And after their careers are over, it's discovered that they suffered from this. So briefly, what is CTE, first of all, and how does it affect Scarecrow in terms of not only what he is experiencing physically, but what it's done to his prospects for being an MMA fighter?
Yeah, so as you described it, it's chronic traumatic encephalopathy. What it is repeated injuries to the brain. And what's, I have personal experience with this as from my career as a physical therapist, and with my wife, who's also an occupational therapist who works in the skilled nursing setting, although hers is not on the sports side. Hers is with more of the Alzheimer dementia side of things. But it's still, you know, from my understanding and from what I remember from my time treating concussion patients and head trauma patients, it's still relatively poorly understood. I mean, it's still got, there's a lot of work being done on it. To your point, it's made a lot of headlines because of that, because it's not just football, it's boxing, it's hockey, it's any of the contact sports. So it results in memory loss. It results in emotional fluctuations that can result in rage and suicidal ideations. You know, it's it, it can manifest itself physically in migraines and tinnitus and all of these things that, you know, only the person suffering can feel and hear and can't see. And so that sort of becomes maddening in and of itself. And so Xavier is experiencing all of these things because he's spent a lifetime in this combat sports. And he's finally getting to the point where it's either going to be him or the disease. And being that there's no cure for CTE, we know who eventually is going to win out.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to read a couple passages from one of my favorite chapters in the book called Here We Go Again, because I think this gives us some insight into what we're talking about, kind of what's going on in the thought processes of Xavier. And I'll just read a couple of the excerpts from this chapter and just have you kind of comment, because I think it sets up kind of not only what he's dealing with, but also kind of what he's experiencing in his life. And I love this because we kind of get a first person point of view in this particular chapter. And this starts on page 140 and goes into page 142. So I'll just kind of hop around and read a couple excerpts and then have you give us some insight and context behind it. You start out by saying, "I've got to be honest with you, my guy. I don't get you. It's like you're determined to be this sad sack all the time when, the way I see it, things are finally lined up the way you've always wanted. But it's time to stop holding on to all the things you think you're supposed to be, acting the way you think people want you to, thinking you've got to be this model son for your poor old suffering daddy." And then later on, at the end of the chapter, "By the way, you ever entertain thoughts of pulling into oncoming traffic again, and I'll steer you into the cars my damn self. We're done with that fake whiny shit. Man up. This fight you've got going is going to be your coming out party. We're about to let people see the real you. Open the door to the basement and let us out. Your pops gave you the keys." So tell us a little bit about that and what's going on there and just kind of the battle that Scarecrow's got sort of in his mind and going on around him and how everything kind of converges there.
So I'll backtrack a little bit. The device that I'm kind of using there was inspired by Smith Henderson's 4th of July Creek, where he had sort of this second person voice that it was never, at least in my reading, it was never entirely clear who that voice was. And it was a technique I loved. I loved that. That's one of my all-time favorite books. I thought that was a fantastic book. And so I thought about how I could make something like that work in this book. And so that the voice that you're reading there is sort of Xavier's unfiltered mind. It's sort of who he'd be if his frontal lobe could talk to him, or his damaged frontal lobe could talk to him. And so that voice reoccurs throughout the book, and that voice gets a little louder for him, you know, as the book goes on, because I thought about what it must have been like for some of these athletes who ended up with a tragic end. You know, for example, Chris Benoit, who's a very famous WWE wrestler, who ended up not only killing himself, but his entire family. And I wondered if what must have gone on in his mind, what he must have heard, what he must have said to himself, you know. So that is where that sort of character, if you will, kind of came from, is sort of what must be circulating in their brains when there's all this damage and gets them to do these awful things that they would never in life consider themselves capable of doing. And so that's the point of that narrator there, is that he's sort of telling Xavier that who he's been all this time has been a lie, that this voice is who he really is. And now that he's having these revelations about his father, that he doesn't have to pretend anymore. You know, like he can be this animal that he says that his brain tells him that he is, and that he can just be this quote unquote alpha dog that can do whatever he pleases, which obviously leads to bad ends. So I hope that answers the question.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that was, I just loved that chapter because I felt like, you know, we were reading the story and we know just through his conversations and what you write early on that, you know, he's got memory loss, he's got headaches that he's suffering from, he's a little paranoid about different things. But I love that chapter because we finally see, as you said, what is he really thinking when he has all these things going on, and he tries to hide it or kind of push it back when he's interacting with other people. Now we see the unfiltered, what's going on in his mind, and what must it be like when he's trying to weigh all of these things and he has these thoughts bouncing around in his mind. I just love that. It was one of my favorite chapters from the entire book. So we look at Scarecrow. He's been suspended. He's serving a year-long suspension, and he's trying to keep himself in shape despite the fact he's sort of fighting CTE and the effects of it. Let me ask you two quick questions. What did he get suspended for? And he's got a great relationship with one of my favorite minor characters in the story, Shot, who is a retired champion boxer. So what got Scarecrow suspended? And then who is Shot and what role is he playing in terms of trying to get Scarecrow back on track and back into the ring?
Well, I don't know if I want to answer the first question because people haven't read it yet. So there's a little bit of, I want there to be a little bit of intrigue here. I'm not going to give that one away just because it plays into some of the central conflict of the story, I think. But as far as Shot is his cousin. Shot's obviously a nickname, but he's a cousin who was a professional boxer who had his career taken away from him because I describe him as sort of he was a Jack Johnson like character. Jack Johnson was a famous black boxer who angered a lot of white folks because he was very extravagant in his lifestyle that he had accumulated by being a championship boxer. And so Shot, unfortunately, pissed off the wrong people, and those wrong people happened to be police, and they damaged his eye during a traffic stop, which ended up detaching his retina and having it replaced with a glass eye, which effectively ended his career. So Shot has continued to stay in the game by running a gym, and eventually he gets involved with fight fixing because running a gym wasn't paying the bills. And eventually that involvement ends up entangling Xavier in ways he didn't anticipate.
Very good. Very good. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that suspension is tied into the plot. So it's good to just tease the reader a little bit and let them know that that's there, but also not make them want to read it because that is an interesting part of the story that's really important. We are speaking with author John Vercher here today on Now Appalachia. He is the author of the terrific new book, After the Lights Go Out. He is an Edgar, Anthony, and Strand Award nominated author. He's also the author of the outstanding book, Three Fifths, which we talked about on the program a couple of years ago. So, John, we'll come back and talk about the book in just a minute, but I want to ask you just a little bit about what you've been up to and how you're doing as a writer. My first question in that vein is, if we were to come into your office or if we were to come into your bedroom and look at your nightstand, what books might we see on the to-be-read or currently reading pile? What are you reading or what are some books that you've read recently that you just really loved?
So it'd be a pretty eclectic mix. So I am reading a number of different books right now. While I've not always been a short story reader, I've gotten into some collections recently. So I'm reading Disha Filial's amazing Secret Lives of Church Ladies. I just received Gabino Iglesias's arc. So I'm excited for his new novel. So I'm excited to dig into that. I'm also reading The Quiet Boy by Ben Winters, which is so far incredibly captivating. And then I just got in the mail today, based on a recommendation from just a friend, a book called The Last Samurai, not the one related to the terrible Tom Cruise movie. It sounds just from the description, it sounded incredible. So I just picked that up. So, and I don't usually read like multiple books at once, but God, there's just been so much great stuff coming out that it's, if I don't try to read more than one at a time, I'm never going to get through all the ones that I want to read. So, and I'm also, what did I just finish? Wiley Cash's new one. I just finished that. So, oh, yeah. When Ghosts Come Home.
Yeah. We had Wiley on back in September when that book came out, September of 2021. And yeah, what a wonderful book that was.
Oh, so good. He's terrific.
Yes. Yeah. He absolutely could. He could write a story about anything and it would be fantastic. And I know what you mean too about, you know, I'm much like you. And I think we've talked about this before. I'm only kind of a one book author at a time. I can only kind of focus on one at a time. But then I feel like if I don't start reading two or three at a time, I'm never going to get through all this good stuff that's coming out.
Yeah.
So it's really great to see all these great books coming out. I wanted to ask you about, you know, your writing process. You talked a little bit about it early on when we were talking about, you know, writing the second book as opposed to the first book and some of the process issues there. And I really appreciate you talking about how you had to throw out all of those words. As you think about this being your second book, and as you think about, you know, moving on to another project, what are some goals that you have for yourself as a writer going forward now that you have two books out into the world and presumably working on something else? Are there goals that you feel like you still want to achieve? Are there still some things maybe stylistically or tactically as a writer that you want to try or do as you look ahead to future projects?
Yeah, I mean, always looking to improve and maybe even innovate a little bit. Not in terms of innovate, reinventing the wheel and anything in terms of what's been written, but experimenting with different styles, experimenting with different voice. The thing that I'm working on now is it's my first time really working in first person, and I like it a lot. It's really just kind of a growth mindset for me. I just want the next book to be better than the last. That's really my biggest goal for any of this stuff. You know, if I can broaden my horizons, I've worked on a pitch for a graphic novel. I've done some TV writing. So if I can continue to expand in those directions, that would be great for me as well. But I'm really just kind of grateful that I even got to publish one book, let alone two. So if I get to publish a third, even better. And if I get to keep living a creative life, then that's my ultimate goal, really.
We're talking with John Vercher on Now Appalachia. He is the author of the brand new book, After the Lights Go Out, featuring Xavier Scarecrow Wallace, who is a mixed race MMA fighter who's on the wrong side of 30. He's fighting CTE, trying to get back into the ring with the assistance of his cousin Shot. And John, I wanted to go back to the book and touch on something we kind of talked about early on, or we said we would get back to early on in our discussion, and that is Sam Wallace, who is Scarecrow's father. We talked about those parallel stories. We've got Scarecrow fighting CTE, but we've also got Sam fighting kind of end-stage Alzheimer's. In the chapter before the one we looked at, Here We Go Again, there was a moment there which really caught my attention. The chapter was Breathe Easy. And one of the things we learn is that Sam Wallace, Scarecrow's father, was white. His mother was black. There's a moment there where Xavier is with his father, and his father uses the N-word. And there's a moment in the book. That was one of those moments when I was reading it that I just kind of paused and was like, oh. But also, it reveals a lot about kind of the dynamic that Xavier had with his father, and it kind of closes the loop of why his black mother left the family years ago. Can you talk about that and kind of what happens in that moment for Scarecrow when he hears his father use that word in that way, what that does for him and kind of what path that kind of sets him on going forward for the rest of the book?
Yeah. So one of the things that Xavier is dealing with as he's watching his own mental state deteriorate is watching his father's, and he's been caring for him since the beginning of that. And one of the things that you tend to see with Alzheimer's and dementia is that for some people, the filters tend to fall away and they say things you wouldn't normally expect them to say. And some of those things can be hurtful and even hateful. And so Xavier resented his mother for leaving because she left at a young age, but he didn't really have a grasp on the nuances of why she did. He just had this sense of abandonment and felt that his loyalty was to his father. And he comes to discover that those loyalties can be misguided. And in fact, he was sort of blinded by his love for his father, as well as his anger for his mother for leaving, even though, as you come to find out later, she was perfectly justified in her leaving and should have left sooner. So it's, you know, I wanted to tackle that because, one, it's a reality of the disease and a reality of the trauma to the brain. But I also wanted to sort of give people insight into both the nuances and the complications of mixed race relationships. They're not always as idyllic as people would like them to believe. Now, I mean, I come from a mixed race relationship. I'm in a mixed race relationship. So, you know, we've always had open conversations about the things that face us as being in mixed race relationships, but that doesn't always happen. And so, you know, people can be together for a long time before they realize that things may not be quite right. And when Xavier is hit with this revelation, it sort of turns his world upside down, but it also gets him to realize that he kind of already knew things weren't right with his father, and that maybe his mother wasn't wrong for leaving. And it's not until they, you know, get to actually, that it's not until later in the book where he actually gets to confront that truth, which not everybody gets to do that, right? I mean, sometimes you don't get the chance to confront the things that you've done wrong or the things that you've misjudged someone for. So that's that.
Okay, very good. And we do get to see Xavier have a moment of redemption by the time he gets to the end of the book. And I'll have you just kind of set this up for us and set the scene for us. He gets a last minute high profile comeback fight. Mm-hmm. What happens there? The circumstances, how is it set up? Who's involved and what's at stake for Xavier, for our Scarecrow, if he's able to win, if he's able to get in here and ultimately win, what's at stake for him and how does all this come about for him?
Oh, sorry. I got to figure out how to do this again without spoiling anything, but yeah, he's offered a fight at the end of his suspension. It's a last minute fight, happens very frequently in mixed martial arts. And it's a chance for him to sort of go out on his shield, kind of go out the way he had intended. But his suspension is tied into a debt that he owes Shot. And Shot's involved with some not so nice people. And because of that, his last fight is not as pure as he would like it to be. And he's entangled in a way that could literally mean life or death for him, as well as Shot. And so without giving anything away, the stakes for that fight become more than just about retiring the way you want to retire. It becomes, can I do this in a way that everyone walks away?
I wanted to ask you just last question, not really related to the book, but about MMA in general. And I was thinking about this because I just finished Eli Cantor's book, his brand new book, which is set in Arkansas. Yeah, just a wonderful book. And I was thinking about football. I was thinking about, you know, Friday Night Lights. I was thinking about Varsity Blues. I was thinking about all these kind of football-esque books and movies we've had come out in the last 10 or 15 years. But we haven't really had anything on MMA a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And I was just wanting to get your thoughts on MMA as a sport. You know, why is it popular? Why is it something that Fox Sports One televises a lot? You know, what is it about that sport that you think is so interesting? Because I imagine, and you've done such a great job with it in this book, but I imagine there's a lot of really rich fodder if someone wanted to kind of set a story in a fictitious world surrounding that sport. There's a lot of really good opportunity there. But your thoughts on MMA and why it's popular and why it seems to be kind of a growing sport that people really get into.
I mean, I'm very biased when it comes to that. So I mean, I'm a lifelong martial artist. I started Taekwondo when I was just a freshman in high school. And then I've trained in mixed martial arts and Brazilian jiu-jitsu for, like I said, half my life. I competed as an amateur in kickboxing, and I actually even got to do one amateur MMA fight. But having said all that, I was a tourist, you know what I mean? Like those were personal objectives for me. My livelihood didn't depend on it. I didn't sacrifice the way these athletes sacrifice on a daily basis. So it's, but having said that, having been immersed in that world to some extent, you know, I love the sport. I think it's one of the most exciting sports you can watch. I was always a big boxing enthusiast. I was my roommate and I in college used to be glued to USA Network every Tuesday night for Tuesday night fights. So I've just always been a fan of combat sports. But because I was a healthcare provider, you know, it was also a bit of a love-hate relationship because I, you know, I knew the cost of those sports, which is why I wanted to write this book. Like I, you know, to your point, there's a lot of other sports have been, as you say, rich fodder for fiction. But, you know, there has never been like the, at least to my knowledge, because I certainly don't want to offend an author out there if they've written it, but there wasn't like the quintessential MMA novel that I knew of. And so again, going back to writing what I wanted to read, I wanted to read The Fat City for MMA. And so this was my attempt at that. But yeah, I love the sport. I think it's growing because it's exciting. It's scary in some ways. But you know, what sport isn't? I mean, I think I made the comparison in the book, you know, a cage fight to me is just as scary as a guy getting hit in the open field. You know, when he's jumping for a catch and he's got his back turned. So, they've got the same car crash equivalency for me. So yeah, that's why MMA and that's why I'm so excited about it.
So as we finish up with you today, John, in our final moments with you, if anyone wants to get in contact with you to talk to you about the book or about MMA or about writing or anything like that, where can they find you? How can they get in contact with you, first of all? And then secondly, when after the lights go out, comes out, where can they get copies? And if they're interested in reading your first book, Three Fifths, where can they get copies of it?
Well, to the last thing, always independent bookstores. Use your IndieBound, use your bookshop.org, you know, and support your locals. If you don't go in person, use those websites. For either book, it's available for pre-order through all of those resources. Where you can find me, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at JVirchWrites. I'll warn you, my social feeds are boring. All I do is usually promote my books. That's about it. There's not that much else there. So, but feel free to stop by if you'd like. And then my website is the highly original johnvircherauthor.com.
Excellent. Very good. Our guest today on the program has been author John Vircher. He's the author of the terrific new novel. It's called After the Lights Go Out, which will be out June the 7th. So you want to mark that date on your calendar and be sure you pick up a copy of this book. And if you're new to John, please go back and read his outstanding debut novel, Three Fifths, which was nominated for just about every major crime fiction award you could think of, including the Anthony Award, Crime Reads Book Award, and more. It's a terrific book. This is a terrific book, John. And I wish you all the best with it. I know it's going to do great. It's a terrific story about so many things, family and relationships and misplaced loyalties. And then ultimately following Xavier Scarecrow Wallace's journey as he tries to redeem himself one last time. So thanks for coming on the program and thanks for this great book and all the best of luck to you with it.
Thanks a lot, Elliot.
We want to take a moment as we finish up on the program here to give a special shout out to our executive producer of the program, as well as our executive producer of all the podcasts that are available here on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Her name is Pam Stack. We appreciate all of Pam's work behind the scenes to make sure that these podcasts are possible and available to you each and every time. We also want to remind you that this is a copyrighted podcast that is owned and operated by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Well, that is going to do it for us this time on Now Appalachia, but please come again next time. And in the meantime, stay well and see you someplace soon, I hope.
You've been listening to Now Appalachia. This is a copyrighted podcast owned and operated by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. For questions or comments about this program, and to learn more about the host, Elliot Parker, and his books, visit his website at www.elliotparker.com. Stay tuned. More outstanding podcasts are coming your way next from the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.